WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. I'm Shayla Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview from the archives with the writer Scott Russell Sanders. This interview originally aired in two parts. Scott and I had talked for quite a long time, and I was reluctant to omit all kinds of interesting things to fit it into an hour. So I made it into a double show. And actually, there's no one due to follow me today, so I'm going to run the whole conversation and go a little over my time here. I hope you have time to listen to it. If you don't, the whole thing will be up on the podcast site later today as well, so you can catch it there. Before I give my guest's bio, I just want to mention that I'm now accepting submissions of writing prompt outcomes for possible inclusion on the show. If you're happy with something that you've written after using a Write the Book prompt, feel free to email it to me. I have submission guidelines on the website. I'll repeat this at the end of the show as well. Okay. Scott Russell Sanders is the author of 20 books of fiction and nonfiction, including A Private History of Awe and A Conservationist Manifesto, which is the book that we talked about when I spoke with him 4 years ago. The best of his essays from the past 30 years, plus 9 new essays, are collected in Earthworks, which was published in 2012 by Indiana University Press. Among his honors are the Lannan Literary Award, the John Burroughs Essay Award, the Mark Twain Award, the Cecil Woods Award for Nonfiction, the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award, and fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. In 2012, he was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He is a distinguished professor emeritus of English at Indiana University, where he taught from 1971 to 2009. He is currently at work on a novel, a collection of short stories, and a book about the meaning of wealth. His writing examines the human place in nature, the pursuit of social justice, the relation between culture and geography, and the search for a spiritual path. He and his wife, Ruth, a biochemist, have reared 2 children in their hometown of Bloomington, Indiana, in the hardwood hill country of Indiana's White River Valley. When I spoke to Scott Russell Sanders in 2009, I began by asking him to talk about how he came to write his book, A Conservationist Manifesto.
When this book came out in April of 2009, on Earth Day, that day I received an email message from a librarian who said it had just arrived in her library and she was alarmed by the title. So I wrote her back and I said, well, I can't know why you were alarmed by the title, but I suspect it's because you heard an echo of, or thought you heard the echo of, a communist manifesto. And I just want to assure you, I wrote to her, that there's nothing in here about communism, but it is a manifesto. And I reminded her in my little note that this country was founded with a manifesto called the Declaration of Independence. And in fact, artists frequently have manifestos. And I wrote a book which is designed to raise questions about the way of life, our present economy, the notion that we are consumers, that we should identify ourselves as consumers, a book that really challenges what the media tell us should be the American way of life, the desirable way of life. And it is a kind of confrontational book. And that's why I use the term manifesto. But a manifesto is a public declaration of values and principles and plans of action, mm-hmm. as of, was the Declaration of Independence. So I see A Conservationist Manifesto as a book which seeks to articulate what's required to shift from a culture based on consumption, which is the one we live in, to a culture based on caretaking, on stewardship, mm-hmm. on looking after one another, looking after the planet, looking after human artifacts, as well as natural artifacts, as well as natural resources. It's a book of essays which were written separately, but they all have to do with this need to shift from, as I said, a culture of consumption to a culture of caretaking. Mm-hmm.
You structure the book around 3 areas of care, caring for Earth, caring for home ground, and caring for generations to come. I'm curious how you decided on these categories.
Well, the first one, caring for Earth, is more traditional in its focus. It talks about what conservation is, and conservation, in my conception, is not just a concern for soils and waters and air and forests and so forth, and of course it includes those things, but it's also a concern for things that humans have made that are valuable, like the library that we happen to be sitting in right now here, the Fletcher Free Library in Burlington, which is a human construction. A conservationist, as I see such a person, is someone who is concerned to preserve and to nurture all those things that are required for human flourishing. And that obviously includes what some people call natural resources, but it also includes human resources, cultural resources. So conservationist is not someone who's just concerned with the environment, nor is the conservationist just concerned with human artifacts and human structures, but rather with the whole range of things that human well-being depends on. We talk about conserving paintings. We talk about conserving old buildings. We talk about conserving land, conserving water, etc., conserving energy. Mm-hmm. So a conservationist is someone who is concerned with what's required for human well-being and taking care of those things. The first part of the book, Caring for the Earth, is really about that range of concerns and range of ideas. The second, Caring for Home Ground, is written about my home ground, which happens to be the Midwest, and in particular the state of Indiana, and within the state of Indiana, the hill country of southern Indiana. So there's a series of essays which are about that region. But the larger purpose of that central section is to invite the reader to think about what his or her own home ground is. We all live somewhere. And the book is an invitation partly to be more aware of, more attentive to the place where we actually come from. So the central section, Caring for Home Ground, is that sort of an invitation. By my talking about how I see myself situated in place and what goes into the sense of place for me, inviting the reader to think about where he or she would identify as home ground and what are the elements of that, what are the qualities of that place that matter to them. And again, I include natural qualities, geology, forests, birds, etc., as well as human qualities, the architecture, the cuisine, the ceremonies and festivals and so forth that are distinctive of that place. So that's what the central section is about. And the third section, Caring for Future Generations, as the title suggests, invites the reader to think about how our present way of life affects the prospect for people who are going to live here after us. My wife and I became grandparents 6 years ago when a granddaughter named Elizabeth was born to our daughter. Since then, two more granddaughters have been born, and a fourth granddaughter is expected by our son and his wife within a month of our sitting here right now, mm-hmm. in December of this year. Becoming a grandparent cast my thoughts further into the future. It's obviously not only my own relations, my own literal grandchildren that I care about. I care about the prospects for all future children. And it seems to me that if we took into account more seriously the effects of our present way of life on the prospects for future generations, we would live more conservingly. Let me apply that, for example, to the so-called debate about climate destabilization. Mm-hmm. That's, climate destabilization is the term that I prefer to climate change or global warming. The people who say we shouldn't do anything about, we shouldn't conserve petroleum, we shouldn't conserve gasoline, we shouldn't conserve electricity, and we shouldn't worry about releasing carbon into the atmosphere, greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, for two reasons, they say. One is it will hurt the economy, and the second is that we enjoy our way of life. And in any case, they say the science is uncertain. Maybe we're not actually affecting, maybe we're not causing the planet's climate to become unstabilized. Well, my response to that is, what's wrong with conserving things, regardless of whether or not we're destabilizing the climate? Why shouldn't we conserve water? Why shouldn't we conserve petroleum? Why shouldn't we reduce the amount of coal we burn so that there will be more for future generations to use? In other words, living conservingly makes sense regardless of whether or not we are destabilizing the climate. I happen to believe, I'm absolutely, utterly convinced that the vast majority of scientists, atmospheric scientists, who say that the release of greenhouse gases, that release is destabilizing the climate, I think they're probably right. But even if they're wrong, why not conserve? It seems to me to make good sense. And if we care about the quality of life that children of the future will inherit from us, if we care about that, then we should live more conservingly. And as to the other argument, the argument that, oh, it will hurt the economy to charge, for example, for the release of carbon into the atmosphere, how could any conservation measure hurt the economy more than our financial institutions have hurt it in the last 2 or 3 years? Mm-hmm. The unemployment, the loss of value, the people's pensions wiped out, and so forth. Our financial institutions have caused more economic damage than any environmental or conservation legislation could possibly do. So the last section of the book really is an invitation to think harder about the effects of our present way of life, our present decisions, harder about how those will affect future generations. And one way I phrase this is to say, I wish when legislators are sitting in their committee rooms debating laws, when executives are sitting in their boardrooms planning, making corporate decisions, when mayors are sitting in their offices, I wish there were a few children over in the corner playing quietly, reading, coloring, just lying on the carpet, playing, so that the men, and they're typically men, but also the women making those decisions, would look over once in a while at those children and realize that these decisions they're making about waging wars, about closing plants and opening plants, about the legislation that they're considering, these decisions do not just affect the lobbyists. They do not just affect corporate balance sheets. They affect the fate of children now and in the future. Mm-hmm. So that's what the third part of the book is about.
Did you write these essays and then start deciding how you wanted to group them in a collection? Or did you sort of set out with this structure in mind and then start writing?
It was the latter. I had some scheme, some vision of the overall structure of the book. And then as I wrote separate essays, either because they were written to be delivered as keynote addresses or endowed lectures here, there, and yonder around the country, or they were written for national conferences of one sort or another, I fit those essays into that larger scheme. Mm-hmm. I've been preoccupied with issues of, human well-being since I was a teenager and right through college. Early on, I thought primarily about matters of discrimination and warfare, and obviously the civil rights movement, for example, had a tremendous impact on forming my concerns, forming my values when I was a boy and right through college and beyond. The women's movement also had a big impact on me, just beginning to learn about what had been the condition of women, the restraints on women's development throughout history everywhere, but especially in this country. And the Vietnam War also had a tremendous impact in forming my ideas about human well-being. So my early concerns when I thought about what do humans need to live well, mm-hmm. they need peace, they need justice, they need educational opportunities. But I didn't think that much about environmental matters. I didn't think that much about nature because it didn't occur to me when I was a teenager and really right through college that nature was endangered. But as history itself, of course, has unfolded since I was a college student back in the 1960s, but also as my reading and my traveling and just my reflection has deepened, I've become aware, of course, that the living systems on Earth that we depend on and that other species depend on are, in fact, damaged and have been compromised by human behavior. We're using up irreplaceable resources at a breakneck pace. We're causing the extinction of other species at a rate that scientists estimate is between 100 and 1,000 times as high a rate as the natural background extinction rate. We're deforesting. We're fishing the oceans bare. That is, we're harvesting fish beyond a sustainable level. So that gradually I came to realize that human well-being doesn't just depend on fair laws, on a peaceful society, on equal opportunities, on high-quality education. Obviously, all those things are crucial to our well-being, but they're not sufficient, because we could have the best laws in the world, we could have the most humane society in the world, and if we so degrade the planet that we and future generations suffer from that degradation, then all those efforts at fixing the human world, if you will go to naught, because mm-hmm. people will still suffer. Right now, in this country, we still, because of our wealth, because of our natural wealth, because of the abundance of arable land, for example, in this country, very few Americans are suffering directly from environmental degradation. But right now, around the world, elsewhere in the world, on the order of 1 billion human beings are suffering hunger, or they're suffering through civil wars, or they're forced to be refugees because of the degradation of land, because of drought caused by climate destabilization, because of the exhaustion of water resources. And so environmental suffering is going on right now to a lot of human beings. People in this country tend not to be aware of that unless they really make a point of informing themselves about it, because we're still relatively insulated from that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So my history of learning gradually to recognize the crucial importance of the health of natural systems, crucial importance to our own well-being, that's been a gradual process that began really when I was a graduate student in the late 1960s, early 1970s, and continues to this day.
Mm-hmm. Early in the Conservationist Manifesto, in an essay called Building Arcs, you describe the shutdown of a protest in your area of Indiana. A group of activists was stopped by police, and when they tried to interfere with the construction of an apartment building that was in a 50-acre wood. Later in the essay, you describe these activists and people like them as the builders of arcs. And you say that they have, this is a quote from the book, the wisdom necessary for dwelling in a place generation after generation without diminishing either the place or the planet. Can you talk a little bit about this incident and your reaction to it?
Well, there have been young people, there's typically young people, but there have been people across the country who have tried to defend forests by illegally building little temporary structures up in the trees. There's the famous cases recently with redwoods in California, but it's happened elsewhere, including in my hometown of Bloomington, Indiana, where, again, typically young people building structures up in trees and camping out there, sometimes even chaining themselves to the trees to try to stop or at least slow down so-called development. It's heartrending for me to see how the forces of the police, the forces of the media, the forces, of course, of the chambers of commerce and the banks, how they're always on the side of what they call development and never on the side of nature. To be on the side of nature, so for example, to think that to have a forest on the edge of a city is more valuable than to have yet one more apartment complex on the edge of a city. There's nobody really in the power structure speaking on behalf of the forest. They're all speaking on behalf, basically, of money. So I'm very grateful to the people of all ages, young or old, who speak up on behalf of nature. When in doing so, of course, they're also speaking on behalf of other species, plants and animals, and so they're birds and butterflies and other creatures that can live in those habitats that are protected. But also humans need access to natural land, not necessarily deep wilderness. I love deep wilderness, and every inch of it that we have we should preserve. But every city, every town, every village needs nearby natural lands where people can go for walks, can look for mushrooms, can listen to the stream rumble over the rocks. If we don't have access to natural land, we tend to fall into the illusion that we own the earth, that we run the earth, that we are the masters of the earth, which of course we are not. We are incapable of providing the conditions that we need to flourish on earth, incapable of producing those on our own. Mm-hmm. We depend on the health of living systems of the earth. So I call the tree sitters, these people who were arrested, and charges were eventually dropped because the community, so much of the community actually spoke up on behalf of the tree sitters who were accused of trespassing and resisting arrest and various other things. They weren't violent, they were very peaceful, but they didn't go, they had to be dragged out of the trees and so forth. So I write about them, and I call them ark builders. And let me say just a word about that metaphor of the ark. Most people, whether or not they've ever opened the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament, as it's often called, and read the book of Genesis, the story of Noah and the ark, even if they've never read that, they probably know the gist of the story. At the heart of the story is the idea that Noah was instructed by the Creator to put on the ark not only human beings, his family, so that after the flood, when the ark returned to dry land, humankind could be restored. But the Creator also instructed Noah to put on the ark a breeding pair of every species. Every species. The instruction is not the ones that are good to eat, or the ones that are pretty, or the ones that don't bite you or sting you, but all species. And so long before there was any formal concept of ecology, let alone the word, it is actually an ecological parable. It's a story which says that through times of trouble, through times of destruction, it's crucial that we protect, that we preserve that which is needed to restore the earth. And in the story of Noah and the ark, what's needed is not only humans on the ark, but all other species on the ark. So after the flood recedes and the ark lands, Noah and all the other creatures get off the ark. And in the book of Genesis, it tells how the Creator says to Noah that I make a covenant with you, I make a promise to you, which will be symbolized by the rainbow, that I will never again flood the earth and destroy human beings. But I also make that covenant with all the creatures that were on the ark with you. So it's a sort of promise from the Creator what we now call biodiversity, that the whole range of living species are inherently valuable. They are worthy in their own right, not because of what we make of them or because how they matter to us, but they have an inherent right to existence. That's what that story tells us. So I think, well, what is the ark? The ark, that boat, okay, it's a boat. But what is it metaphorically? What it is metaphorically is a vessel, a container that holds that which must not perish, that which we need to preserve so that we can restore, or we can bring human communities, and we can bring the earth itself back to a state of health. Mm-hmm. So biodiversity clearly is vital, but so are various human skills. Books are arcs. Libraries are arcs. Many institutions, public access radio stations, I would argue, are arcs. That is, they hold a possibility, they preserve a possibility. Through times when those possibilities are under assault. Mm-hmm. So for example, the possibility of non-commercial public conversation which doesn't require pandering to big corporations in order to be on the air. That's vital to the health of a democracy and to the health of a vibrant culture. Well, the public television and public, both public access and also PBS and National Public Radio, but also public access radio in towns and cities across the country, are themselves arcs that hold these possibilities, that carry them. So I began thinking about the various ways in which, or the various kinds of arcs. So when a city or a nonprofit land trust protects a piece of land so that the people of the city and visitors to the city can walk along the riverfront or walk along, in this case, along the lakefront, that piece of land itself is an arc. It preserves certain possibilities, certain kinds of experiences that will disappear if those places are paved over or turned into apartment complexes or Walmart parking lots, that will disappear unless they're preserved. So a park can be a vessel, a book can be a vessel, an institution, a community chorus, keeping a certain kind of musical life going in a community. Those are various sorts of arcs. One of my ambitions in the book, in writing the book, was to speak to people for whom the Judeo-Christian religious tradition is very important. And that includes, of course, a lot of Americans. By drawing on some of the major teachings of the Bible, such as the teaching implicit in the story of Noah and the Ark, mm-hmm. drawing on a number of the dominant teachings in the Bible to show their implications for a life of conservation, for a concern for protecting the earth and the full diversity of life on earth. There are a lot of other kinds of arguments that go through the book, based on science, based on practicality, based on common sense, and so forth. But one thread that goes through the book is this appeal to certain fundamental teachings, as I see them, of the biblical tradition. And the Hebrew Bible, or the so-called Old Testament, is shared, of course, by Jews, by Christians, by Muslims. So it's one of the single most widely read and thought about and influential texts that humans have ever created. And it's filled, of course, with lots of contradictory sorts of teachings, a whole range of teachings. And you can find in the Bible justification for a dominating view towards the earth. And that tends to be the one that gets picked up. And because people, it's very flattering to humans to be told or to think that we are the center and the purpose of creation. I happen to believe that's not true, but at least you can find a justification for that in the Bible. But you also find a very powerful tradition in the Bible, both the Old Testament and the New Testament, a very powerful strain of thought and teaching which tells us that we are guests on earth, that we are here to experience, to learn from, but not to own, not to dominate the earth. We're here as guests just passing through. And I think that's the more profound teaching.
I want to talk a tiny bit more about that essay. You later list the reasons that are generally given for this sort of development, for the apartment complexes and such, that people need somewhere to live, people need jobs, investors deserve a return on their capital, the city must grow, et cetera, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. So how do we reconcile these needs with all that's being sacrificed, or vice versa, do you suppose?
It's hard. The average size of the American house, the newly constructed house, has increased by 50% since 1970, while family sizes have declined. So one of the reasons there's so much sprawl in America is that people are building bigger and bigger houses for smaller and smaller families. That takes up more land, it takes up more wood, it takes up more copper for the wiring, it takes up more light fixtures, more furnishings, etc. Measured sheerly by its contribution to the gross domestic product, that's all good. Measured by its impact on the earth and on the prospects for future generations, it's bad. It's wasteful. We would require much less land if we built smaller houses, smaller apartments, if we built more densely instead of spreading houses way out in the suburbs, if we concentrated housing more, yes, people do need some place to live. There's no shortage of housing in America. There's a shortage of affordable housing. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of unsold houses in America and unsold apartments and abandoned buildings. Mm-hmm. One of the things we could do, and Burlington, I think, from my impression, has done a pretty good job of this, is to reclaim a lot of abandoned buildings that had some prior use as a warehouse or a factory even, and now have been reclaimed for condominiums or for apartments, so that you maintain a more compact footprint for the city. So sprawl, it seems to me, is driven both by our moving to grander and more palatial kinds of housing, but also it's driven by the lack of intelligent city planning, community planning. If we allow developers, in effect, to drive the shape of the cities, they have no regard whatsoever for the overall shape of the city. They're just concerned with how much money they can make from a particular development. There are some exceptions, some developers who are sincerely concerned about the quality of life in their community, but frankly, most aren't. Many of them don't even live in the cities where they're funding the developments. Mm-hmm. And yet in this country, especially the further west you move from New England, the more resistant people tend to become to the whole idea of civic planning. People say, oh, government, I don't want government to control what I do with my land. Well, it's not government, it's your fellow citizens. That's government, for better or for worse, is our best mechanism for expressing, for seeking to serve the common good, the public good. For asking, what does the community need here? Will the community benefit from having this sprawl over here, or will the community be better off if we have more compact development? That's a kind of question that corporations are never going to ask themselves. Developers are never going to ask themselves. The only people who can ask that are citizens, and the only way they can express it is through their government. So we need better planning across this country at the local, state, and national level. Regional and national level. We need much more vigorous concern for and defense of the common good, the public good, to ask of every project, what's the effect of this going to be on the community? Not who's going to benefit financially. Those folks will look out for themselves. We don't have to worry about that. But what will be the effects on the community? And some developments are beneficial for the community, and some are disastrous for the community. And a lot of sprawl is driven by corporate and private development, private investor decisions that benefit a small number of people and damage the community. So that's one issue. The other issue is jobs. People say anything that hurts jobs is bad. Anything that creates jobs is good. Well, there are a lot of different ways to generate jobs. For example, economists have shown, and repeatedly in studies since the 1960s, for every dollar that you spend on education, you create three times as many jobs as you do for every dollar you spend on the military. Mm. For every dollar that you spend on insulating houses, retrofitting houses, putting new windows in an old house, putting insulation in the walls and in the ceiling, putting in a more efficient furnace. For every dollar you spend doing that, retrofitting old buildings to save energy, you create three times as many jobs as you do through putting another dollar to support the financial industry. So the question is, what are the jobs that we want? Do we want more soldiers? Do we want more drug dealers? Do we want more prison guards? Do we want more mechanics fixing badly manufactured automobiles? Or would we rather have more teachers in smaller classes? Would we rather have more doctors? Would we rather have more nurses? Would we rather have more artists? In other words, jobs are not all equally valuable to humankind. And many of the jobs that exist in our society now, and many of the ones, unfortunately, that were not fortunately or unfortunately, that were have been lost in this current economic debacle that we're suffering through, I'm not sure we want back. For example, when one of the first effects of the rapid increase in gasoline prices was that the recreational vehicle industry suffered a precipitous decline. And Indiana, my home state, is one of the major focuses one of the major centers for the manufacture of these big bus-type recreational vehicles. And many of those plants have shut down or they've cut way back. And I feel for the families who've lost those jobs, but I don't aspire to a society, to a future economy that will recreate all those jobs, not manufacturing big recreational vehicles. The earth can't afford it. The future can't afford it. I'd rather have those people with their skills building something that we actually need, something that's that benefits the public good, the common mm-hmm. good. Mm-hmm. Many of those factories, for example, could be adapted to build electric light rail cars. Many of them could be adapted to build wind turbines, to build solar panels and so forth. People need to be employed, obviously. They need jobs, but we need to be more thoughtful about the kinds of jobs we want to create.
In the essay titled Stillness,
yes,
you admit to the guilty indulgence of a small hut mm-hmm. where you go to be alone, to work, to think, to be still and quiet. And you say, I drift so often into past and future, jerked around by memory and expectation, that I lose the savor of the moment. I have come to this empty room to break free of tasks and deadlines, to cast off worry and grief. And when I was reading this essay, I started to wonder if the nature of our frenetic lives has in itself rendered us incapable of stillness, particularly of stillness without solitude. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
We have to actually physically remove ourselves in order to get stillness. Is that...
Well, first of all, I admit in that essay, as you would have found in reading it, that I need to make a special effort to withdraw from the many, many activities I'm involved in order to gather myself, in order to have a certain clarity of mind. So that's a constant struggle for me. That is, I completely live in the hasty, accelerating, frenetic professional world, work world, that most of our listeners live in. And so I understand that. It doesn't come naturally to me to be quiet. I have to make special provision to do that. So to answer your question directly, solitude is necessary for me to find a degree of collectedness. As long as I'm involved in my work as a teacher, my work as a writer out in the world, I'm scattered. My attention is scattered. My energy is scattered in many, many different directions. The closest I come to a consistent meditative practice, I do some kinds of very amateurish but sincere sitting on a pillow meditation. I do that irregularly, but with great affection when I'm able to do it. But week in, week out, the kind of meditation that is most collecting for me, most gathering for me, is actually the practice of writing. Mm-hmm. When I'm at my keyboard composing something, and when the composing is actually going well, and much of the time, of course, it doesn't. I'm there, nothing's really working. But when it goes well, when the flow begins, I feel a sense of selflessness. That is, my whole awareness of myself as a person, as an ego, as someone with lists of tasks to do and so forth, that all goes away, and I'm simply in the process of writing. Many artists and I think carpenters and musicians and people in many different walks of life occasionally experience this, so they would understand what it feels like to be in that, to be wholly given over to the work that you're doing. And it might only, that sense of flow may only be a few minutes long, or it might be a whole morning in rare instances. And when I emerge from it, blinking, I realize that this time has passed and there are words on the screen or on the page that have somehow come out of me, but they don't actually seem to have been produced by the small self that runs my life most of the time. They seem to have come from some larger self that is less hectic, less frantic. Ironically, that studio, the little study that where stillness, that essay is set, in the essay I say that I'm not sure. My wife and I had this place, and the idea was that it would be a retreat place and that I would go there and write, and also just to withdraw from a pretty frantic lifestyle. but that I also felt guilty owning it.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt guilty because although we live in a very small house in town, it's a very nice house, which my wife and I have restored inch by inch during the 30 plus years we've owned it. Very comfortable house. And so many people on earth do not have one roof over their heads. And here we owned two roofs, and it just seemed wrong. And in fact, I wasn't able to keep it. We decided to sell it. I just couldn't bear to feel that we had this extra place. And nobody else really was using it. We would loan it to friends periodically, but our kids had other places, our two children and their families had other places to go, and so they made very little use of it. So after a while, after maybe 7 or 8 years, my wife and I talked it through and decided we would sell it. So the place where that essay is set, we no longer own. An artist acquaintance of ours owns it, and she's making excellent use of it. She lives there. She makes excellent use of it. What we did do was the land that surrounds that place, we donated to the local land trust.
Mm-hmm.
It's all hardwood forest, beautiful hardwood forest. So that's now public land, publicly accessible land. It's owned by the nonprofit land trust. But I wasn't able to keep a retreat place just because I didn't feel justified in our owning it.
Yeah, that came through, that there was a certain conflict for you. I want to back up 1 second. You mentioned losing yourself in the wonderful meditation of writing, and you mentioned a keyboard. Now, a lot of your work seems to have been written in a journal, and I'm curious, how much do you compose at the keyboard, and how much are you mostly journaling? And then,
well, I use a journal. I have one in this satchel sitting on our table right now. I use a journal when I'm traveling. When I'm
in the
taking long woods.
Not taking a computer in the woods.
Right, I never take the computer in the woods. When I'm in the woods, when I'm hiking, I have various different sized notebooks that are sticking in pockets here and there, and I write down notes. But my actual composing, where I'm writing something that I hope will become publishable, where I'm really composing some piece, an essay, a short story, I do all that at a keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been writing. And I say a keyboard, it's a computer keyboard, but I started writing in college on a manual typewriter. I learned in high school to touch type, which was actually a great skill to acquire. So from high school onward, I've been able to touch type, which means I don't have to look at my fingers. I just can look at the page or the screen, and therefore I can really invest my mind in the writing and not think about the mechanics of getting the words down.
I'm thinking this might be a good time for you to read.
Well, what I'm going to read is the last 2.5 pages of the book. It's from an essay called For the Children, and I take that title from a wonderful poem of the same title by Gary Snyder.
Okay.
And it's in the form of a letter addressed to children of the future, not any particular child, certainly not children who are biologically related to me, but just children of the future. And what I try to do in this letter for the children is to tell them what I have loved, what I have valued about the earth during my time alive, the creatures I've loved, the kinds of landscapes I've loved, and also what my hopes for them are, what I hope they will be able to experience when they live, when they come into the world. And so at the same time, I'm telling them, I'm speaking, of course, to the contemporary reader, to the present reader, and inviting the present reader to think about the effects of our lives on the prospects for future children. So this is just the last 2.5 pages. I don't think the listener needs any context. But I'm speaking to children of the future. When I think of all the wild pleasures I wish for you, the list grows long. I want you to be able to chase fireflies as they glimmer in long grass, watch tadpoles turn into frogs in muddy pools, hear loons calling on clear lakes, glimpse deer grazing and foxes ambling, lay your fingers in the paw prints of grizzlies and wolves. I want there to be rivers you can raft down without running into dams, the water pure and filled with the colors of sky. I want you to thrill in spring and fall to the ringing calls of geese and cranes as they fly overhead. I want you to see herds of caribou following the seasons to green pastures, turtles clamoring on shore to lay their eggs, alewives and salmon fighting their way upstream to spawn. And I want you to feel in these movements Earth's great age and distances, and to sense how the whole planet is bound together by a single breath. As I sit here in this shaggy backyard writing this letter to you, I remember a favorite spot from the woods behind my childhood house in Ohio, a meadow encircled by trees and filled with long grass that turned the color of bright pennies in the fall. I loved to lie there and watch the clouds as I'm watching the high, surly storm clouds rolling over me now. I want you to be able to lie in the grass without worrying that the kiss of the sun will poison your skin. I want you to be able to drink water from faucets and creeks, to eat fruits and vegetables straight from the soil. I want you to be safe from lightning and loneliness, from accidents and disease. I would spare you all harm if I could. But I also want you to know there are powers much older and grander than our own. Earthquakes, volcanoes, tornadoes, and thunderstorms, glaciers, floods. I pray that you will never be hurt by any of these powers, but I also pray that you will never forget them. And remember that nature is a lot bigger than our planet. It's the shaping energy that drives the whole universe, the wheeling galaxies as well as water striders, the shimmering pulsars as well as your beating heart. Thoughts of you make me reflect soberly on how I lead my life. When I spend money, when I turn the key in my car, when I vote or refrain from voting, when I fill my head or belly with whatever is for sale, when I teach students or write books, ripples from my actions spread into the future, and sooner or later they will reach you. So I bear you in mind. I try to imagine what sort of world you will inherit. And when I forget, when I serve only my own appetite, more often than not, I do something wasteful. By using up more than I need, I add to the flames that are burning up the blessings I wish to preserve for you. I worry that the choices all of us make today, in our homes and workplaces and offices and legislatures, will leave fewer choices for you and your own children and grandchildren 50 or 100 years from now. By indulging our tastes for luxuries, we may deprive you of necessities. Our laziness may cause you heavy labor. Our comfort may cause you pain. I worry that the world you find will be diminished from the one we enjoy. If Earth remains a blessed place in the coming century, you will hear crickets and locusts churring away on summer nights. You will hear owls hoot and whippoorwills lament. You'll smell wet rock, lilacs, new mown hay, peppermint, lemon balm, split cedar, piles of autumn leaves. On damp mornings, you'll find spider webs draped like handkerchiefs on the grass. You'll watch dragonflies zip and hover, then flash away so fast their wings thinner than whispers. You'll watch beavers nosing across the still waters of ponds, wild turkeys browsing in the stubble of cornfields, and snakes wriggling out of their old skins. If we take good care in our lifetime, you will be able to sit by the sea and watch the waves roll in, knowing that a seal or an otter may poke a sleek brown head out of the water and gaze back at you. The skies will be clear and dark enough for you to see the moon waxing and waning, the constellations gliding overhead, the Milky Way arching from horizon to horizon. The breeze will be sweet in your lungs, and the rain will be innocent. The rain has reached me now, rare drops at first, rattling the maple leaves over my head. There's scarcely a pause between lightning and thunder, and every loud crack makes me jump. It's time for me to get out from under this big old tree and go inside to keep this paper dry. So a few more words, my darlings, and then goodbye for now. Thinking about you draws my heart into the future. I want you to look back on those of us who lived at the beginning of the 21st century and know that we bore you in mind. We cared for you, and we cared for our fellow tribes, those cloaked in feathers or scales or chitin or fur, those covered in leaves and bark. One day it will be your turn to bear in mind the coming children, your turn to care for all the living tribes. The list of wild marvels I would save for you is endless. I want you to feel wonder and gratitude for the glories of earth. I hope you will come to feel, as I do, that we are already in paradise, right here and now.
Thank you very much. That was Scott Russell Sanders reading from a conservationist manifesto published by Indiana University.
Yes.
I love that essay, and I love that ending. I'm glad you read it. I found myself, when I was reading that, somewhat chagrined that these things do still occur. These things still do exist, and to some extent, although I've enjoyed a lot of them, I've never seen a grizzly paw print, mm-hmm. and I've never seen the turtles clamber on shore to lay their eggs. And as I read this, and I think you said this before you read it, it struck me that the passive audience receiving this message now, as opposed to the children for whom you wrote it, may be the ones who have the power to change things.
Yes.
And, or are the ones who have the power to change things. And that your goals will be best achieved by affecting that audience, today's readers, and hopefully someday the children can read it and feel that it was accomplished. So that's what you had in mind.
Yes, indeed. One doesn't have to have ever seen a grizzly paw print, as I have actually had the chance to see in Alaska and in Montana, or see turtles clambering on shore to lay their eggs, as I've also had the chance to see. Or one doesn't have to ever have seen whales to want them to be in the world,
right.
To want them to be available for other people to witness, or simply to know that they exist. For example, one of the arguments for drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife, drilling for oil and natural gas in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and there's an essay in here, as you know, about that proposal. One of the arguments is, well, so few people ever go up there to see the caribou migrating, to see the polar bears and so forth, so why should we protect it? And my argument is, it matters to me, although I have no plans to ever go there. It doesn't matter to me because I personally am going to benefit from it. It matters to me because there's a beauty alive there that is inherently valuable. And that for those who do go there, the people, the native people who live there, the few people who are able to go there, of course it's a cherished, treasured experience. But even if no human ever set foot there, it would be inherently valuable in my view. There's a great deal on this earth that we have already developed, to use that word, that we've already turned to our purposes. And it seems to me that we should leave what's left. We should leave the portions of the earth that we have not already exploited. And we should leave those for other creatures. And for those humans who are able and moved to go visit those places, to experience those places, that's all well and good. But I think that the primary reason for saving wild places is for the creatures that live there.
Mm-hmm. In the late 90s, you wrote a book called Writing from the Center. This is a quote from that book. The writer who is steadfast rather than footloose risks being dismissed as regional or quaint. What could be more backward than staying put in a culture that rushes about? How can you see the big picture from a small place? This is a theme that readers will find again in the Conservationist Manifesto, these ideas about rushing and never slowing down or being still. I wonder if you can, this is a theme that runs through your work, and also the theme of writing from home, writing from the center, which you touch on in this book, and I think probably that caring for home ground is certainly a reflection of that. So can we just talk about that a tiny mm-hmm. bit more?
We live in a society that is fixated on celebrity. Not just celebrity of people, but celebrity of places. So that there's a relatively small number of cities in America, obvious places like New York and Los Angeles and Seattle and so forth, that are thought of as real places, alive places, places that are good to live in, places where interesting things happen and interesting people live. And those certainly are all wonderful places. But most Americans live elsewhere. Most Americans live in small towns in Vermont or farm villages in Indiana or in medium to small cities like Burlington or Indianapolis or St. Louis and so forth. And those are real places too. Real human life occurs there. And it seems that it shouldn't be necessary to say that. But many people who grow up there and become writers or become photographers who grow up in places that are not the celebrity cities tend to dismiss the places they come from as not worthy of their attention. Nobody's ever going to publish a book that is set in rural Vermont. Nobody's ever going to publish a book that's set in a small town in Bloomington, in Indiana. You have these preconceptions. And to a considerable extent, the media reinforce those preconceptions. Well, my view is that human life happens everywhere humans live. And the things that matter to humans, life and death and falling in and out of love and birth of children and the pursuit of causes and the development of skills and pursuit of work and so forth, those things happen wherever there are humans. Mm-hmm. And all places deserve attention. They deserve not necessarily uncritical praise. I think loving a place and caring about a place includes the willingness to recognize its shortcomings and to, insofar as it's within one's power, to work to remedy those shortcomings, to not just condemn them, but to actually try to overcome them. So I live in a place, more generally, I live in this region of the Midwest, which by and large is a place that writers, great American writers, have tended to leave. So there's a whole long list of great American writers, Mark Twain and Toni Morrison and T.S. Eliot and Ernest Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald and Willa Cather, very long list of marvelous American writers who were born and grew up in the Midwest and all left to go elsewhere. There are now, thanks to universities primarily, there are now many marvelous writers living and working throughout the Midwest. But many of them...
Even people from New York City, probably.
Even people from New York City. But unfortunately, many of the writers who now live and work throughout the Midwest, thanks to the positions that people enjoy, as I enjoy one, at universities, but many of them don't set their work in the Midwest. They set them elsewhere, places that they think of as more interesting, more desirable. I've been very intent on setting my work where I live, beginning with my hometown, then moving out to southern Indiana, then Indiana as a whole, and then the Great Lakes region and the Midwest. Not because I think it's the most beautiful place or the most interesting place or the most important place, but it's my place. It's the place that I know. And it's a place that deserves attention, deserves art being made about it, as does every other place on earth. We live in a society that so values mobility. Mm-hmm. And mobility certainly has great benefits and advantages and attractions. I understand them. I travel a lot. But I have a home base from which I travel. And I bring back to my home base, where I've now lived with my wife for 38 years, I bring back to that home base the benefits of what I learn elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And the home base, to some extent, if only modestly, is then enriched by my travels. So I don't travel just for my own sake. I travel for what I'm able to bring back and invest in my teaching, in my writing, and in my dealings with neighbors.
Yeah. You wrote an essay for the AWP Chronicle some time ago, and you mentioned something along these lines. How can one think responsibly about life in our time or discover the full potential of literature without a lively interest in other cultures?
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like you really feel that you write best about the place you're from, and particularly if you have other knowledge to bump that up against. Is that?
Yes. What's called provincialism is an attitude that where you're from and what's known in the place where you're from, what foods are eaten, what religion is practiced, etc., is all you need to know about the world. And if you do have that attitude, whether you're from New York City or from Bloomington, Indiana, you are a provincial. That is, you are narrow-minded. Sure, there may be wonderful things where you are, but it does not begin to exhaust the possibilities, the rich possibilities of human culture. So it seems to me any place is enriched by knowledge that comes from elsewhere. And again, that includes big cities as well as small towns as well as homes in the country. In my own experience, there certainly are people who live in rural places or live in small towns, live throughout the Midwest, say. There certainly are people who are provincial in that sense, narrow-minded. They're not curious about other people, other places. But I've met just as many people who are narrow-minded in that way from Chicago and from Los Angeles and from New York City. So it, being provincial is not a function of where you live. It's a function of your attitude about the adequacy of what you actually know about your home place. Is that enough to know? You can. We live in this age when you can learn a great deal about almost any culture on the planet. You can learn it through the internet. You can learn it through television, through films, through books, and so forth. You can learn it if you have the time and have the money and have the inclination. You can learn a lot of it from travel. I have done a fair amount of traveling in other countries, but mainly earlier in my life. When I was in graduate school for 4 years in England, my wife and I traveled a great deal. Mm-hmm. Especially in Europe. But there are many huge swaths of the world that I have never visited and probably never will visit. And the main reason for that is ecological. It's very, very costly to move people around the planet. But another reason is that I live on this continent that itself is endlessly diverse in its culture, in its biology, in its geography. And I will never in my lifetime exhaust 1% of what there is to know about this continent I live on. The mm-hmm. cultural varieties, the architecture, the creatures, the landscapes. So, and I'm so fascinated by and so moved by the American landscape and the variety of geographies and cultures that have mixed here in this country. I'm so moved by it that when I get the chance to travel, this is where I want to travel. Mm-hmm. I'm very interested in other countries. I read a lot about them. I seek out every opportunity to talk with people from other countries, to read books by people from other countries, to watch films about them and so forth. So I try to learn more about, as much as I can, about the rest of the world. But I actually have focused my own travels on this country.
Mm-hmm. I find myself wondering if you feel the same way about time. Do you personally feel more of a pull to write about your own time?
Well, I certainly, in my early writing, very interesting question. In my early writing, I wrote mainly about the past.
Uh-huh.
I wrote about family history, not in a biographical way, but I wrote fiction that was inspired by stories my mother had told me about her ancestry, stories my father had told me about his boyhood and his ancestry. So they were fiction, but they were fiction inspired by things from the past. One of my earliest novels is a historical novel set in Ohio in 1813, about a murder that occurred there, a historical novel. And then I went through a period of time when I actually wrote novels that were set in the future that are therefore published as science fiction novels. And they're in the near future. I wrote them in the 20th century, but they were set in our present century, in the 21st century, mid to late 21st century. And they were efforts, of course, to comment on my own time, but to do so by projecting possible developments into the future. So it's a kind of speculative fiction that exaggerates or pursues current trends, technological and cultural trends, to imagine where they might lead if we continue to pursue them.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote this fiction which was really set in the future, but of course it was about my own time. In the same way in which my fiction about the past was set in the past, but was really about my own time. So that the novel that I referred to, it's called Bad Man Ballad, which is about this murder, an actual murder that occurred in early Ohio, early in the 19th century. At the root of that was my own brooding about the Vietnam War and about the obsession with violence, with guns, with essentially warfare that characterizes our culture. We live in a very militaristic society.
Right.
And I wrote a novel set in the past as a way to think back to some of the roots of that, which have to do, I'm sure, I'm convinced, as are a lot of much better informed historians, it has a lot to do with our continent-wide encounter with the wilderness, including our encounter with all the creatures who live there, including all the native peoples who live there. So we live in this place now called Vermont because our European ancestors killed or forced out all the native people who occupied this place, who lived here, for whom this was home. And that was true right across the whole country. So I have, I've gradually worked my way back to the present, if you will. In my present work, in a conservationist manifesto, the final section of the book, as I mentioned earlier, is projected into the future. It's really talking, it's inviting the reader to think about where our society is headed, mm-hmm. what our legacy is for future generations. But the book starts very much with the present. And
what we can do now.
And what we can do now, right, absolutely.
Right. You've said that you live and have led a rather ordinary life.
Mm-hmm.
Does it ever feel intimidating to you writing memoir, knowing people will be reading about what you consider to be an ordinary life?
In some ways, my answer to that is similar to my answers about place. Most people do not live in extraordinary places. They don't live in sensationally beautiful or wildly historic or globally significant places.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't. Similarly, most people don't lead lives that are full of sensational events. And yet all lives deserve attention. And I'm a writer, as I've said it explicitly in my writing, such as, for example, in the preface to my next most recent book, A Private History of Awe, I say in the preface to that book that this is an account of the most luminous moments in a very ordinary life. And my point of writing about my life is not because I think my life is inherently important or inherently worthy of the reader's attention, but as an invitation for the writer to think about his or her own life. Because after all, most people don't lead sensational lives. They're getting the kids up out of bed and see if they're getting them to school, they're paying bills, they're going to work, they're buying groceries, they're doing the laundry. And there may be high points and low points in their life, but most of our lives are filled with unsensational events. They fill our days, and sometimes they fill our entire lives. Nonetheless, those are real lives. Those are lives that have depth to them, have significance to them, have beauty, moments of insight in them, and they deserve our attention. They deserve serious reflection. I think too many Americans live vicariously through celebrity culture. They look at the wealthy or the famous on television, or they see them in magazines, and they think, oh, those people have real lives. Those people have interesting lives, rich lives, whereas my own life is so plain and so uninteresting. That seems to me almost tragic abandonment of reflection and appreciation of one's own life, no matter how plain one's own life may seem, no matter how hard it may be. It's worthy of our attention, and if we pay attention to it, it will enrich our experience. Mm-hmm. And we will have more to give to the people around us as well.
I would say that a conservationist manifesto has a sort of hopeful, it's not too late undertone running through it. And I know you wrote a book called Hunting for Hope, which collected writings concerning that subject, remaining hopeful despite the world's sometimes bleak-looking position. Can you talk about how you remain hopeful? I know that's a big subject, but...
Yeah. Hope is a big subject, but it's also a vital one. To some extent, hope is temperamental. Some people are despairing by temperament, and some people are hopeful. I make a distinction between hope and optimism.
Mm-hmm.
And I make it in that book that you referred to called Hunting for Hope. Optimism is the confidence that things are going to turn out fine. Hope is the conviction that however things are going to turn out, however they may turn out, there's always good work to be done. There are real sources of healing and renewal that we can draw on to do good work. And I'm hopeful in that sense, but I'm not optimistic. That is, if you say, am I confident that things are going to turn out right, that humans are going to really come to grips with these enormous challenges that we face, am I confident that's going to happen? No, I'm not confident. In fact, I think the odds are pretty long. On the other hand, do I think that there are grounds for doing good work, healing work, renewing work, both as an individual, as part of communities and parts of our species? Do I think that there are grounds for real hope that we can address these problems and create a more humane, a more conserving society? Yes, there definitely are. And I'm glad that you feel a sense of hopeful mood in a conservationist manifesto, because it's definitely there. I wouldn't write a book about taking care of the earth, taking care of human constructions, if I didn't believe that there would be many people who would respond to that, who would resonate to that appeal, people who are in fact making that effort in their lives right now, and people who are inclined to do it, who might find the book the impetus to invest themselves more in living simply and in taking care of things. I wouldn't be a teacher if I weren't hopeful. One of the reasons I think that I do feel a profound sense of hope for the human future is that I have seen so much learning occur. One of the great privileges and gifts of the life of a teacher is whatever frustrations, whatever shortcomings one has, may have as a teacher, you see learning occur. You see this repeated evidence of the human capacity to learn. I experience it in myself, of course. I've learned my whole life, and I expect to learn as long as I'm alive. And I see it in students. I see it in people who write to me having read one of my books, that they've learned something from that, they've been given something from that. So hope is an enormous subject, and these few remarks are not adequate to it, but I do feel that it's one of the responsibilities of elders to think hard about our present challenges, and also to speak honestly and forthrightly about what we see as the way forward. That is, elders are people who are not defined just by chronological age, although they tend to be older chronologically, but they're people who've turned their thoughts towards the needs of those who come after them. In other words, they're no longer preoccupied with their own careers, their own needs even, but actually with the needs of those who are alive now and who are going to be alive after they're gone. And I see myself as an elder in that sense. I don't mean that I have laying claim to any particular wisdom or authority, certainly, but I do feel a sense of obligation.
Okay. What are you working on now?
Well, although I'm best known as a writer of essays and nonfiction, as it happens, right now I'm working on a novel. Started as what I thought was a collection of linked stories, but has evolved into a novel. The characters wouldn't stay compartmentalized in their stories. They keep spreading out to adjoining chapters. So it's become a novel. And it's a novel, really, that although it has pays a lot of attention to settings, because I've always loved geography and landscape, it's really about relationships, which most novels are about. And it's partly a way for me, having brooded for a long time on the grand ills of and challenges of the world, environmental degradation and war and peace and so on, it's sort of a relief for me to think about a much more small-scale, intimate set of relationships and just explore those for a while. I will go back to the big global concerns.
Well, and I'm sure they'll be there as well.
Yes, they're not going to go away. So right now I'm working on a novel. And I have an idea for a book of either essays or a book of chapters, nonfiction, that would be about efforts to create what I call arcs in the Conservationist Manifesto, efforts to create alternative economies, alternative social structures, alternatives to the dominant patterns that and very destructive patterns that we have now in America. So, for example, local foods as opposed to international industrially grown agriculture, local economies as opposed to global corporations, craft work, hand work as opposed to mass production, manufacturing. So a book that would be a series of profiles or studies in these efforts all across our country to create an alternative economy, an alternative society.
Oh, wow. That sounds wonderful. What advice do you have for writers who occasionally get stuck in their work or have trouble moving forward?
Writing can be blocked by a lot of factors. Just the busyness of our lives. We don't have enough clear space to think through the project. We lose the energy that was required to carry it on. We lose the spark, the dream, the inspiration. But let's say you have the time, you have the space, you are really eager to write, but you're still struggling to find your way forward in a piece. And there are a lot of different influences that can block someone. One of them is having too high an expectation of the draft that you're working on. Unless it's perfect, or unless it's earth-shattering or unprecedentedly great, it's not worth writing. Well, I understand that because I hear those voices in my own head as I write. But I think you have to allow yourself to pursue a work even though you know it needs to be improved, needs significant improvement, so that you have something down that you can then rework, because you can't improve something until you have something to work on, work over, to revise. So one thing to do is to defend yourself against that voice in your head that says this isn't good enough, is to speak back to it and say, well, I know it's not good enough, but it's also not finished. It's a draft. It's on the way towards something that will be good enough. So just talk back to that little voice. There's another voice that discourages us and blocks us in our writing, and that's the voice that says, who's going to ever care about this? There's so much to read in the world. This will never get published, or even if it is published, nobody's going to read it. It won't matter to them. Well, that may be true. There is a lot written, and a lot more written than is ever going to get published. But my response to that little voice is to say, even if nobody ever else reads this, even if it's never published, the practice of writing it is going to enrich my life. It's going to deepen my understanding of this life that I'm leading, this mysterious human existence. It's going to deepen my understanding. It's going to give me the satisfaction of having shaped something out of words, the way another person might make a chair out of wood, or might make bread out of dough, or a pot out of clay. There's something inherently satisfying in making something out of words. So I just say to that little voice that says, this is not important, will never be of interest to others, I say, so what? It matters to me. I'm going to learn from this. I am learning from this, and I'm going to get, however hard and frustrating and arduous the actual making may be, I'm going to get the satisfaction of having made something out of words. And then maybe, just maybe, if I make it well enough, maybe actually some other people will take an interest in it. Maybe I'll send it to my friends on my email list. Maybe I'll show it to people in my writer's group. Or maybe it'll get published somewhere and more people will read it. Maybe that will happen. But I don't need to know that that will happen, or even be confident that that will happen, in order to feel that the writing itself is worthwhile. One of the things I do when I feel blocked that way is I open a book that I love, and I have lots of them. Every writer has lots of books that you love, writers that you love, and so forth. I open such a book, and I just open it anywhere, and I just read a few paragraphs, which is a way of reminding me, yes, this is why people write. Mm-hmm. They write in the hopes that they might make something this good, or almost this good, or maybe for a few pages they'll write this well. It's as though you're a musician and you don't want to practice. Because who wants to practice, right? But you love music, and you put on a piece of music that's absolutely spellbinding, and that reminds you, okay, that's why I practice. I practice because I love this music, because I don't have to imagine that I'm ever going to be this good, but I can imagine that that's the direction I want to aspire to. That's where I want to move. So that's the kind of thing I will do when I get blocked. Or I'll maybe go back and read something occasionally that I've written earlier, maybe something that got published, and remember how raw it seemed when I started it, how unsure I was when I started it, how long I had to grope around before I found the final shape that's now in print, just to remind myself what it felt like and how uncertain I was early in the phase of that. And yet here was this finished thing that I now feel good about and that other people seem to find some value in. And just reminding myself of that is reassuring.
Great. Thank you very much. Well, listen, thank you so much for talking
with me. It's a great pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Scott Russell Sanders. You can read more about his work on his website, scottrussellsanders.com. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Ann Barbano's Next Frontier, an issues-oriented program about autism, disabilities, and diagnoses. The Next Frontier can be heard every Thursday at 6 on The Radiator. Recipient of a 2012 Governor's Award, The Next Frontier features local, national, and international guests. Visit Ann Barbano's The Next Frontier on Facebook and Twitter for updates. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for the coming week. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the publication of The Feminine Mystique. The Dorothy Elling Memorial Library presents longtime Vermont humanities scholar, library trustee, and former teacher Barbara Meter, talking about the book and its role in the women's movement. Tonight, Monday, March 11th at 6:30. More information at 802-878-4918. The Fletcher Free Library in Burlington presents author, UVM professor, and Middle East expert Greg Gauss, speaking about the troubled regions that he studies and writes about. Has the Arab Spring become an Islamic winter? That'll be in the Fletcher Room at the library March 13th, 2013 at 7. The Northshire Bookstore in Manchester Center presents Gretel Ehrlich with her book, Facing the Wave, A Journey in the Wake of the Tsunami. That's Wednesday, March 13th at 6. Flying Pig Books presents Tanya Lee Stone Thursday, March 14th at 4:30, sharing two of her works, Courage Has No Color, The True Story of the Triple Nickels, America's First Black Paratroopers, and Who Says Women Can't Be Doctors, The Story of Elizabeth Blackwell. More information at 802-985-3999 or flyingpigevents at gmail.com. And finally, the Dorothy Elling Memorial Library in Williston holds its Brown Bag Book Club Friday, March 15th from 12:30 to 1:30. This month, the discussion concerns A Tree Grows in Brooklyn by Betty Smith. More information at 802-878-4918. Today's Write the Book prompt is actually inspired by a writing conference I went to at the end of last week and over the weekend, the AWP 2013, which took place in Boston. AWP stands for Associated Writing Programs. I've been going to the meeting pretty much every other year for about the last 10 years, and attendance has just exploded. This year they had some 12,000 writers by the time they had people do pre-registration and walk-in registration. It's a lot of people, and they need a lot of space. So when you go to a conference like that, there's crowd control to think about and which panels and workshops and readings are of most interest to you. Then there are social concerns, like, what's the name of that guy who's walking towards me? I forget where I know him from, you know, things like that. And then there's dietary concerns, like, do you have time to stand in line for a salad and a cup of coffee, or should you just skip lunch and try to get a seat in that How I Got My Book Reviewed by Oprah panel? And then there's also the issue of having to sit for long periods of time in the panels that you do get a seat in, on maybe not the most comfortable seats, things like that. But then there's also all the wonderful stuff you get out of conferences, all the things that you learn and the people you get to see, and it can be a lot of fun. So anyway, this week's Write the Book prompt is to write a poem, a story, an essay, or a personal narrative of some sort about an experience you've either had or can imagine having at a conference. It can be any kind of conference or meeting or reunion, whatever inspires you to write. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. Write the Book radio show has a Facebook page. If you're a Facebook user, please search for us and like us. Write the Book radio show. If you're interested in sharing the show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. And archived episodes are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And I said it earlier at the beginning of the show, I'm going to repeat it now. I'm accepting submissions of writing prompt outcomes for possible inclusion on the show. If you're happy with something you've written for, if you've used a Write the Book prompt to write something that you're happy with, email it to me. I have submission guidelines on the website. Also, if you have comments about the show, news about book-related events in the area, or if you have a guest to recommend or a writing prompt to suggest, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Remember, please, that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about the station is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.